Our speaker today, Rabbi Klein, is a rabbi at the Tiferet Israel congregation in Cleveland, Ohio. He has a PhD. Not only is he ordained in the by the Reform Jewish Hebrew Institute of Religion in Cincinnati, but he is also has a PhD in philosophy. He studied in Germany and has a tremendous following in Cleveland. We love to come to his Saturday morning Torah study programs, as well as programs that he gives throughout the year on various subjects. He's got a regular bunch of groupies, and I would imagine that a good many of them are here today. So without further ado, Rabbi Klein.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to Fred. Can you turn that down just a little? I'm getting some feedback. So nice to be here with you this afternoon. Before I launch into my topic, I want to thank several people for helping to bring us here and to making everything so smooth. Richard Spivak, and to Judy Farber, and to Jerry and Marcia, and of course to Fred Livingstone. It's really been flawless, and really appreciate it very, very much. After I took a shower this afternoon and began to get dressed, I thought to myself, shall I wear pants or shall I wear shorts? Seemed to me from looking around over the time that we're here and being here in the past that shorts are the norm. But I thought to myself, you know, I think I feel a little bit more rabbinic in pants. Then when I went to look for my belt for my pants, I recognized that I drove up in shorts and don't have a belt. So maybe that was a sign that I should be wearing shorts. This is a talk on Jewish humor. I hope that an illustration of Jewish humor is not my pants falling down during the talk. So if they begin to, I hope that you'll ignore them and pay attention to something about what I'm saying. In any event, I'm going to talk on the subject of Jewish humor or why we laugh. I'm going to make several preliminary remarks just in terms of some ideas about humor. Then I'm going to illustrate what I have proposed, and then we'll open it up for comments and questions. When I give talks like this, thinking that I have really come up with some awfully good pieces of Jewish humor, people in the audience come up with even better ones, so that I'm hoping that while I'm talking, you'll be thinking about your thoughts about humor, about Jewish humor, about what it means about Judaism and Jewish society, and that we'll be able to engage in a lively conversation with one another. So let me begin by comparing jokes with great pieces of art. Great pieces of art obviously can be seen as aesthetic objects. Take the late pictures by Monet of the abstract depictions of water lilies, or take a great Shakespeare sonnet or a late Beethoven string quartet. These can be understood and appreciated just for what they are. They give us enjoyment. We feel a kind of palpable sense of their greatness. And that can be enough for us. On the other hand, these great works of art can also be understood on the level of deeper meaning. What do Monet's depictions of the water lilies say about what we might call his mysticism? What does do the late Beethoven string quartets, which, as you know, have no continuous narrative line, but are oftentimes very disjunctive, moving from one kind of music to another. What does it say about Beethoven's view of the world, its complexity, and its possible harmony? What does a Shakespeare sonnet tell us about the complexities of human nature? So the same can, I think, be said for elements of humor, jokes and stories. They can be understood on the aesthetic level. We can laugh at them. We can be entertained by them. We can be surprised by them. We can be entertained by the pictures that they convey to us. But on the other hand, humor can also be seen on a deeper level. And especially ethnic humor, the humor of a people, in this instance, the Jewish people. Humor can give us access to the psychology of a people, its experiences, its joys and its sorrows, its ideals, its hopes, its way of coping with complex reality, its defenses, its celebrations. Humor, we might say, on this deeper level, and of course I am not avoiding what I'm calling the more surface level of enjoyment, but on the deeper level we might say that humor is one of the ways in which a people talks to itself about itself. It's a way of self-identification. It also can express the relationship of a people to other peoples, a minority people, to the larger majority culture. Irving Howe says the following: "It's a remarkable fact that a people of tragic destiny insisted on making laughter a major strand of its folk tradition." Jewish humor as a way of coping, of remaining sane in a sometimes difficult world of historical and social circumstances. So here are four questions I want to ask preliminarily about Jewish humor. What is it that makes it Jewish? Secondly, what is it that makes it funny? Thirdly, beyond and behind what makes it funny, what makes it serious? And finally, what functions do elements of Jewish humor serve? Let me briefly deal with each of the four questions. What makes Jewish humor Jewish? I'm suggesting one of three things, one or more. First of all, it reflects an ironic stance toward the world, a mode of stepping back, of observing, of commenting on, of suggesting more than one meaning to things. Perhaps humor undermines expected meanings. We Jews are famous for thinking things through, for finding layers of meaning behind the surface. Irony is one way of talking about that. Irony gives us a kind of double vision on things, the way things seem and the way things really are. For example, the world, we might say, is not always the way official Judaism says it is. And humor uncovers some reality behind conventional appearances. The world often strikes us as crazy, as absurd, as incomprehensible. Our authorities are not always what they seem, or we would like them to seem to be. That's the first element of Jewish humor. Secondly, of course, any ethnic expression is going to use the vocabulary of that ethnic group. Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Jewish mysticism, early on made the point that mysticisms of all peoples fundamentally are after the same thing. That is a sense of intimacy, in Hebrew, devekut, of connectedness to God. What then distinguishes different forms of mysticism? The particular vocabularies in which they express themselves. So that Judaism expresses its mysticism through the language of Torah. Christianity expresses its mysticism through the language of Jesus Christ and the imitatio Dei, the imitation of the way in which Christ lived as a mode of getting closer. So in the following joke, you're going to see something of the language of Judaism. Well, a man brings some fine material to a tailor, and he asks the tailor to make him a pair of pants. When he comes back a week later, the pants are not ready. 2 weeks later, the pants are not ready. 4 weeks, 6 weeks later, the pants are still not ready. He comes back 7 weeks later, the pants are ready. He tries them on. They fit perfectly. Nevertheless, when it comes time to pay the tailor, he cannot help kidding him a bit. You know, he says, it only took God 6 days to make the world. And it took you 7 weeks to make just one pair of pants. Ah, replies the tailor, just look at these pants and then look at the world. This joke employs the language of Judaism, both in its kind of cultural and its religious sense. It's a way of stepping back, isn't it, to explore, but through something delicious, the unacknowledged, the something that religions don't always acknowledge. And that is, even though if we believe in God, the God who created the world, the God who is master of all that is, nevertheless, God's world is often very, very problematic. Much more problematic than the pants of a humble tailor. A third element is the kind of intensity that we find expressed through Jewish ethnic articulation. Distinctive characteristics of a culture are often exaggerated. They're often caricatured. They're even obsessed over. Mark Twain says that the Jews are just like everyone else, only more so. What are some of the emblematic characteristics of Jewish life and Jewish experience? What are the things that might be caricatured, that might be focused on in Jewish humor? Here's a partial answer. The Jewish family, the Jewish mother and grandmother, Jewish leaders, rabbis, cantors, synagogue presidents, assimilation, financial success, suffering, complaining, anti-Semitism, God. Jewish humor is going to take some of these central elements in the vocabulary and the life of Judaism and work with them, both to entertain and to educate. Question two, what makes Jewish humor funny? Well, what is funny in the comparison of the tailor's pants and God's world? It turns the world upside down. The humble tailor, not the Kaddish Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, becomes the exemplar of the way to get things right. But he does so on a ridiculously small scale. A humble tailor in his small little shop. What keeps the humor, and especially when it is as biting as this joke, from being blasphemous? I think this is an interesting question. I think it depends upon who is telling the joke. Insiders to a culture can get away with saying things that outsiders cannot. Those who are committed to a certain culture or group can say things that those who are not committed might not be able to say. So elements of ethnic humor, in some sense, are inside jokes. Question three, what makes Jewish humor serious? I want to suggest to you that Jewish jokes, Jewish anecdotes, make claims about the world. They tell us something about life, about the problems we face, about the absurdities, as well as the glories of the world. And humor is a mode of rhetoric. Rhetoric is the art of persuasion. And anyone who wants to persuade anybody of something needs to find an appropriate method to do so. Humor sneaks up on us and gets us to accept its, I might say, message before we know it. The surprise of humor alters our sense of things. Question four, what functions do elements of Jewish humor perform? That is, what is humor for? What are the larger purposes that it serves? Now, philosophers have long meditated on this question because humor in its various forms is a ubiquitous feature of human communal existence. And so now I want to present to you four different theories of the function of humor, and then I'm going to try to illustrate them. First of all, we have a theory known as the incongruity theory. Humor expresses to us the lack of fit, the incongruity between a conventional concept, an accepted concept or worldview, and the way the world really is. Look at these pants and look at the world. Expresses an incongruity between conventional faith and reality. For example, between our habituated respect for our leaders and for what we know our leaders really to be. Let's take a very tragic but contemporary example, the Penn State debacle. Recently there was a sign outside just below the statue of Joe Paterno, which said Joe Paterno was not God. That's not a piece of humor, but it points out implicitly the incongruity between the way in which certain leaders are lionized, idolized, and the way they come to be seen. The incongruity between our words and our deeds, between the way we should behave and the way we do behave. Let's call this the cognitive theory of humor, because it tells us something about ideas and about the way things are. Let me give you an example. A king was making his way through the provinces, and he noticed a man in the crowd who bore a striking resemblance to the king's own children. He beckoned the man and he asked, "By the way, was your mother at one time in service in the palace?" "No, Your Highness," was the reply, "but my father was." This is a joke that always takes a little while. The king and we expect that royalty can be a little flirtatious, but not women, only men. Now, his assumption is, if there's a likeness, it's the mother, but not the father. And so this subverts a conventional understanding and makes us laugh at it. The incongruity theory. The second theory is the so-called superiority theory. Humor, according to the 17th century philosopher Thomas Hobbes, gives rise to a feeling of sudden glory, which we feel when we find a way to assert some kind of superiority over others. This form of humor is a form of aggression. It's employed as a weapon of the weak over the strong, of the victims over the persecutors. And it reflects an attempt to gain some superiority over those who persecute us. It's a way of reducing the enemy and elevating ourselves. We might call this a political theory of humor because it deals with the question of power relationships. The third theory is what we might call the release or the relief theory. This, of course, was championed by Sigmund Freud. Humor gives us an opportunity to express, to release, to deflect socially forbidden energies and drives, essentially sexual drives, aggressive drives, that have been stored up through repression. Jokes succeed in liberating an otherwise suppressed or censored thought or a feeling via the disguise of humor. Let's call this the psychological theory of humor. Finally, let me describe what I might call the happiness, well-being theory of humor. In a 1928 lecture on humor, Freud remarked that, now I quote him, "Humor also has something fine and elevating. It refuses to be hurt by the arrows of reality or to be compelled to suffer. It insists that it is impervious to the wounds dealt by the world. It signifies the triumph. It signifies the pleasure principle, which is strong enough to assert itself here in the face of adverse real circumstances. Humor, therefore, can involve the reassertion of who we are, the celebration of who we are and our special qualities. It represents the triumph of the ego and of the health of a people striving to survive and to thrive in a difficult world." Let's call this the ethical theory of humor, ethos, coming from the Greek word that means character, a celebration of character. Okay, now let me illustrate these various theories through some examples. Humor that points to the incongruities of life. Now, as we know, Jews have, from the very beginning, questioned everything. One of our glories is a healthy skepticism, and it's always been one of our life forces. Way back in the biblical period, we have the icons of our people and religion question. Aaron and Miriam question their brother Moses. Nathan the prophet comes in and dares to question King David. Abraham and Moses and Jeremiah and the psalmist make so bold as to question God. And we have, from the beginning, scrutinized our ideal types and our cultural totems and people and ideas that we venerate. The idea, for example, of the repentant sinner or the ideal marriage. Let's look at one of the icons of Jewish life, if I may say so. The rabbi. Why do you laugh? Well, there's a story about the man who comes into services one Shabbat morning quite late. Service begins around 9 o'clock. He comes in about 9:45. With great fanfare, he comes down the center aisle. He causes people in the row he wants to sit in to move, to get up, and he sits right in the middle of the row, right in front of the rabbi. The rabbi is a little bit flustered by this, but he goes on. He goes on with the Torah service and the Haftorah, and the Torah scroll is put away, and then comes time for the sermon. The rabbi waxes eloquent, as rabbis are wont to do, and at great length. About 25 minutes into the sermon, he sees this man in the second row right in front of him begin to look at his watch, and he looks at his watch again, and then he gets up. And with great fanfare again, causes everybody in his row to get up. He goes over to the aisle and he begins to go to the back. At which point the rabbi is so upset by this that he interrupts himself. And he calls out to the man and he says to him, "Sir, you came in late and you made a great deal of fuss sitting right in the front row. And then right in the middle of my sermon, you get up and again, with great fanfare, you disturb other people and you begin to leave. Why are you leaving?" The man replies, "Well, I have to get a haircut." And the rabbi says to him, "Why didn't you get a haircut before you came to shul?" And the man says, "Before I came to the shul, I didn't need a haircut." Puncturing the pretensions of our leaders. Rabbis, I'm sure you've not had this experience yourself, sometimes do go on at too great a length. And just before Rosh Hashanah, a team of terrorists invades the shul and takes the rabbi, the cantor, and the temple president hostage. By the way, every time I tell these stories, people in the audience, some of them are nodding. I know some of these have been heard before. So he takes the rabbi and the cantor and the temple president hostage. Hours later, the governor hangs tough and won't give them the $1 million ransom they asked for, nor will he give them the getaway car or the jumbo jet. The terrorists gather the three hostages in a corner and inform them that things look very, very bad for them and that they're going to have to shoot them all. But just to show that they're not really such a bad bunch, they will grant each hostage one last wish. "Please," says the rabbi, "I've worked all summer preparing my Rosh Hashanah sermon. What a waste it would be for me to die now without having the opportunity to present it before an audience. I'll go happily if you'll just let me recite my sermon. It's only an hour, maybe 90 minutes, no longer, I promise." They promise to grant him his wish. "Please," says the cantor, "after 50 years practicing the Hineni prayer, I think I have finally got it just right. What a waste would it be to die now and not to be able to sing it one last time to an audience. It's only 20, 25 minutes long, and then, believe me, I'll die happily." Well, the terrorists promise to grant him his wish too. And then they turn to the shul president. "Please," says the president with tears in his eyes, "shoot me first." What about the Jewish intellectual, the Luftmensch? This is, I think, a scene from Woody Allen's Play It Again, Sam. And the character, Alex Allen Felix, finds himself at a museum one afternoon, and he tries to pick up a very attractive young lady. They're standing right in front of a Jackson Pollock painting. He says to her, "What does this picture say to you?" She replies, It restates the negativeness of the universe, the hideous, lonely emptiness of existence, nothingness, the predicament of man forced to live in a barren, godless eternity, like a tiny flame flickering in an immense void, with nothing but waste, horror, and degradation, forming a useless, bleak straitjacket in a bleak and absurd cosmos. When he finishes, Alan turns to her and he asks, "What are you doing Saturday night?" To which she replies, "Committing suicide." To which he replies, "What about Friday night?" Is knowledge and intellectual expertise the pure, objective search for truth that we sometimes think it is? Or do we sometimes use our knowledge in terms of promoting ourselves and our power relationships with other people? Maybe that seems a little too abstract for such a wonderful joke. But it does seem to me on a deeper level that this piece of humor is also puncturing the pretensions of the intellectual and pointing out some potentially ulterior motives to what they are up to. An old man reads about Einstein's theory of relativity in the newspaper, and he asks his grandson, who's a scientist, to explain it to him. "Well, Zadie," he says, "it's sort of like this. Einstein says that if you're having your teeth drilled without Novocaine, a minute seems like an hour. But if you're sitting with a beautiful woman on your lap, an hour seems like a minute." The old man considers this profound bit of thinking for a moment, and then he says, "And from this he makes a living?" Or the one about the Yeshiva University rowing team. It's funny already. Actually, this joke has two laugh moments. The Yeshiva University rowing team, and then comes the joke. Now, unfortunately, as might be expected, the rowing team comes in dead last every single race, and they have for the entire season, even though they practice and they practice every single day. They never manage to come in anything but last. So finally, the team comes up with the idea to send Morris Fishbein, its captain, to spy on Harvard's perennially victorious team. Okay, so he schleps off to Cambridge, hides in the bushes right near the Charles River, where he carefully watches the Harvard team at its daily practices. After a week, Morris returns to the yeshiva and he says, "I have figured out the secret. Now I'm going to tell you." "Well, what? Tell us," they said. "Really, what we should be doing is having only one person yelling, 'The others should row.'" Intellectuals. What about idealists? Well, here's a lovely line by the great 19th century philosopher Hermann Cohen, who was an anti-Zionist. Now, you know, the Zionists, especially in Theodor Herzl's version of Zionism, had very utopian goals to create a great society and to solve for both Jews and Gentiles the problem of anti-Semitism. Hermann Cohen said about the Zionists, "The trouble with those fellows is that they want to be happy." 5, 6, 7. Okay. Well, I think that this points out. The real talk is tomorrow. Okay. I kind of like that one, but I can see that I'm the only one, and you like it too. Anybody else? All right. What about this notion of the perfect marriage, finding the perfect mate? So a Hasidic family was very concerned that their son, who is now 30 years old, is still unmarried. So they decided to call a marriage broker and to ask him to find a good mate for their son. So the broker comes over to their house and spends a long time asking many questions of the son and of the parents as to what they wanted in a wife and a daughter-in-law. They gave him a detailed list of requirements. Well, the broker says to them, it's going to take me quite a while to try to satisfy all of these needs, but I'll do my best. Sometime later, he calls up the family and says, I have found a suitable match for your son. So he comes over to visit the family. He tells them of the wonderful woman that he has found. He said, she's just the right age for your son. She keeps a glatt kosher home. She regularly attends shul. She davens the prayers by heart. She's a wonderful cook. She loves children. She wants a large family, and to crown it all, she is drop-dead gorgeous. Well, after hearing this, the family is so very impressed that they begin to get excited about the prospects of a wedding, and they hope in the near future. But just as the marriage broker is getting ready to leave, the son says, wait a minute, I have one more question for you. Is she good in bed? To which the marriage broker says, some say yes, some say no. How about the Messiah? In a little town, tucked away in the woods and far from the main roads, the Jews of that town were afraid that the Messiah would come and pass them by, not even know that they were there. So they decided to build a tower on the outskirts of town, and they appointed one of the town's beggars to serve there as a watchman. If the Messiah should come, the watchman would give him directions to the town and they would not be passed by. Now one day, a stranger approaches the tower and the watchman comes down to greet him. What are you doing in the middle of the forest? The stranger asked. I sit on top of this tower and I wait for the Messiah, as answered the watchman. How do you like your job? The stranger asked. I'm sure it doesn't pay you very much. Well, that's true, answered the watchman, but it's steady work. The Messiah's not coming? You got it? Good. You got it, but it's not funny. Okay, it is funny, I think. Okay, how about prayer? Prayer and the efficacy and the power of prayer. A CNN journalist heard one day about a very old Jewish man who had been going to the Western Wall to pray twice a day, every day, for a long, long time. So she decided to go and to check the situation out. She went to the Western Wall. And there he was, walking slowly up to the holy site. She watched him pray, and after about 45 minutes, when he turned to leave, she came up to him and she said to him, pardon me, sir, I'm Rebecca Smith from CNN. What's your name? Morris Fishbein, he replied. Sir, how long have you been coming to the Western Wall and praying? For about 60 years. 60 years, she said. That's amazing. What do you pray for? I pray for peace between Christians, Jews, and Muslims. I pray for all the walls and all the wars and all the hatred to stop. I pray for all the children to grow up safely as responsible adults and to love their fellow man. I pray for world peace. Well, she says to him, how do you feel after doing this for 60 years? He replies, I feel like I'm praying to a wall. There's a lovely little, I think, piece of humor about God in the Talmud, of all places. Let me read you this lovely story that some of you may know. One day, Rabbi Eliezer brought forward every imaginable argument to show that a certain oven is kosher. But the rest of the rabbis did not accept his arguments. So he said to them, if the law is as I say, let this carob tree prove it. Thereupon the carob tree tore itself out of its roots and moved 100 cubits out of its place. Some say 400 cubits. No proof, the others said, can be brought from a carob tree. Again he said to them, if the law is as I say it is, let this stream of water prove it. Whereupon the stream of water flowed backward. No proof can be brought from a stream of water, they rejoined. Again he argued, if the law is as I say, let the walls of the schoolhouse prove it. Whereupon the walls inclined to fall. But Rabbi Joshua, one of his opponents, rebuked those walls. And he said, when scholars are engaged in discourse about legal matters, why do you think you have a right to interfere? Hence, the walls did not fall in honor of Rabbi Eliezer, but they did not stand upright in deference to Rabbi Joshua. And they remain like this to the present day. Again, he said to them, if the law is as I say, let it be proved from heaven. Whereupon a heavenly voice cried out, why do you dispute with Rabbi Eliezer, seeing that all matters of the law are as he says? But Rabbi Joshua arose and exclaimed, quoting Deuteronomy, the law is not in heaven. What, the rabbi say, did he mean by this? Said Rabbi Jeremiah, what he meant was that the Torah has already been given at Mount Sinai, and therefore we pay no attention anymore to a heavenly voice, the voice of God, because you, God, long since expressed the following thought, which you wrote down in the book of Exodus, after the majority must one incline. You gave us a method. Rabbi Nathan was met by Elijah many years later, and he asked him, you know, Elijah was one of two people in the Bible not to have died. Enoch was the other one. And so the rabbis speculate about what Elijah is doing in the meantime because he's supposed to usher in the Messiah. And one of the things that Elijah does, according to Jewish legend, lore, is that he comes down and walks the earth and he answers questions of rabbis and so on. So Rabbi Nathan meets Elijah and he says to him, what did God say at the moment when the rabbis told him, stay out of this discussion? Elijah replied, God laughed, saying, my children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. This is a lovely story in its own right, but it's also got some humor in it, doesn't it? It suggests, it makes a double move. The first move is that God, the creator of all meaning and being, the one who can split the Red Sea, make the sun stand still, feed the thousands with manna, is not in charge of what the rabbis are doing. The rabbis have taken charge of the Torah and its meaning, and we no longer accept any miraculous interventions. Now, this is a stunning move on the part of the rabbi. the rabbis. The second move is that God is happy about this because God recognizes that they no longer need to be dependent on miracles or someone else doing their work for them, that they have taken charge in God's name. They quote the Torah. They quote God's word to tell God what God wanted from the Torah. This is not ha-ha humor. How do I know this? But there is something, there's an incongruity here, isn't there? And told in a very, very delicious way. It's a double move of both rejection and acceptance. Rejecting God's role in the ongoing argument in God's name. What about God's justice? Let's take the question, why do the wicked prosper and the innocent suffer? Woody Allen replies, countering the comforting cliche, that the good people have at least one advantage over the wicked, namely that they sleep better at night. Woody Allen notes, but the wicked seem to enjoy their waking hours more. Just what kind of a world did God create? In the beginning, there was nothing. God said, let there be light. There was still nothing, but at least now you could see it. Or a favorite New Yorker cartoon of mine, which pictures a preacher declaiming from the pulpit, and on the eighth day, God said, let there be problems. And there were problems. What about the notion of repentance? Repentance on Yom Kippur. So, on the way to Shul, two enemies decide to reconcile with one another. So one declares to the other, let's let bygones be bygones. After Yom Kippur, one said to the other, I wish for you everything you wish for me. To which the other replies, starting again already? What about, let's turn to the relief theory for a moment and talk a little bit about that. What about Jewish mothers, hapless Jewish men, these stereotypes? Do they reflect some kind of anxiety in the Jewish soul? What about Jewish parents overweening ambitions for their children? Do we care too much? Who deserves, we wonder, praise when our children succeed? Are we looking for some status? Are we looking for nachas? Can we face the reality of what it is that parents might really want, among other things? So here is a personal in a Jewish newspaper. Mr. and Mrs. Marvin Rosenblum are pleased to announce the birth of their son, Dr. Jonathan Rosenblum. Some of you have heard the following. Three elderly Jewish women are seated on a bench in Miami Beach, each one bragging about how devoted her son is to her. The first one says, my son is so devoted that last year for my birthday, he gave me an all-expenses-paid cruise around the world, first class. Ah, the second one says, my son is even more devoted. For my 75th birthday, he catered an elaborate affair for me. He even gave me money to fly my good friends down from New York. Oh, the third one says, that's nothing. My son is the most devoted of all. 3 times a week he goes to a psychiatrist. $200 an hour he pays. And what does he speak about the whole time? Me! Here's one of my favorites. This one I really like a lot. So Goldstein has been in analysis now for 10 years, seeing his analyst 4 times a week. Finally, the analyst says to him that they've achieved all their goals and that he doesn't have to come back anymore. The man is terrified. Doctor, he says, I've grown so very dependent on these meetings. I just can't stop. The doctor says, you really can. You really are much, much healthier now, and you don't have to come back anymore. But Goldstein prevails upon him, and so the doctor relents. And he gives Goldstein his home phone number. If you ever need to, he says, you can call me at home at any time. 2 weeks later, Sunday morning, 6 o'clock a.m., the phone rings at the doctor's house. It's Goldstein. Doctor, he says, I just had a terrible nightmare. I dreamed you were my mother, and I woke up in a terrible, terrible sweat. So the doctor says, so what did you do? So Goldstein says, well, I analyzed the dream the way you taught me to do, and then I tried to go back asleep. But I just could not fall asleep. So the doctor said, what did you do? Well, I went down to have a little breakfast. And the doctor says to him, and what did you have? He said, I had a cup of black coffee. To which the doctor replies, you call that a breakfast? That is a good one, isn't it? A mother goes into her son's room, and she says to him, you've got to get up for school, Bernie. Bernie pulls the blanket over his head. I don't want to go to school. You have to go, his mother says. I don't want to. The joke says W-A-N-N-A. I don't want to. The teachers don't like me, and all the kids make fun of me. The mother pulls the blanket down. Bernie, you don't have a choice. You have to go to school. Yeah, he says. Give me one good reason. You're 52 years old and you're the principal. A Jewish woman is wheeling her grandson in his baby carriage. A woman stops her. What a beautiful baby, she says. Ah, that's nothing, the grandmother replies. You should see his pictures. His pictures. Now, Becky's grandson and his wife are coming to visit her for the first time. Shows she is giving him directions to her flat. You come to the front door of the Golders Green block of flats. I'm in flat number 32 on the 14th floor. At the front door, you'll see a big panel of buttons. With your elbow, press button 32. I'll buzz you in. Come inside. The lift is on the right. Get in, and with your elbow, hit number 14. When you get out, I'm on the left. With your elbow, hit my doorbell. Grandma, that sounds so easy, he replies. But why am I hitting all these buttons with my elbow? What, you're coming empty-handed? The stereotypes. What about the unflappable, formidable Jewish woman. An elderly Jewish woman is leaving the garment district to go home from work. Suddenly, a man who has been walking toward her stands in front of her, blocks her path, opens up his raincoat, and flashes her. Unruffled, the woman takes a look at him, and she says to him, this you call a lining? A Jewish lady's grandson is playing in the water. She's standing on the beach, not wanting to get her feet wet, when all of a sudden a huge wave appears out of nowhere, crashes directly over the spot where her grandson is wading in the water. The water recedes. The boy is no longer there. He simply vanished. She holds her hands to the sky, screams and cries, "Lord, how could you? Have I not been a wonderful grandmother? Have I not been a wonderful mother? Have I not given to B'nai B'rith? Have I not given to Hadassah? Have I not lit candles every Friday night? Have I not gone to shul every Shabbat? Have I not tried to live my life in the way in which to make you proud?" At which point a loud voice booms forth from heaven. "Okay, okay." A few minutes later, another huge wave appears and out of nowhere crashes on the beach. As the water recedes, there's the boy, standing there, smiling, splashing around as if nothing happened. The loud voice booms from heaven again. "Have I not returned your grandson? Are you now satisfied?" To which she responds, "He had a hat." Let me give you an example or two of the superiority theory, the way in which humor is used by a minority, maligned, persecuted group against its persecutors in order to gain some kind of victory and also to earn some self-respect through humor. So in the early 1900s, an old Jew is traveling alone in his compartment on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. The train stops and an officer in the Tsar's army gets on. He and the Jew travel together in the same compartment for a while in silence. Suddenly the officer grabs the Jew by the lapels and he demands, "Tell me, why are you Jews so much brighter than everyone else?" The Jew, of course, trembles and he's silent for a moment. And then he responds, "It's because of the herring we eat." The officer quiets down, and the trip resumes. Soon the Jew takes out a piece of herring and starts to eat it. The officer, curious, asks him, "How many more pieces of that herring do you have?" "A dozen." "How much do you want for them?" 20 rubles. Large, large sum of money. So the officer takes out the money and gives it to the Jew. The old man gives him the herring, and the officer takes a bite. Suddenly the officer stops. "This is ridiculous," he said. "In Moscow, I could have bought all this herring for just a few kopecks." "You see," says the Jew, "it's working already." How about this one? Several centuries ago, the Pope decreed that all the Jews either had to convert to Christianity or to leave Italy. There was a huge outcry from the Jewish community, so the Pope offered a deal. He would have a religious debate with the leader of the Jewish community. If the Jews won the debate, they could stay in Italy. If the Pope won, they would have to leave immediately. So the Jewish people met and picked an aged and wise rabbi to represent them in the debate. However, as the rabbi spoke no Italian and the Pope spoke no English, they agreed it would be a silent debate. On the chosen day, the Pope and the rabbi faced one another. The Pope raised his hand and he showed three fingers. The rabbi looked back and raised one finger. Next, the Pope waved his finger around his head. The rabbi pointed to the ground where he sat. The Pope brought out the communion wafer and the chalice of wine. The rabbi pulled out an apple. With that, the Pope stood up and declared that he had been beaten and that the rabbi was too clever. The Jews could stay in Italy. Later, the cardinals met with the Pope and they asked him, well, what had happened? So the Pope said, well, first I held up three fingers in order to represent the Trinity. He responded by holding up one finger to remind me that there is still only one God common to both of our beliefs. Then I waved my finger around my head to show him that God was all around us. And he pointed to the ground to say that God was also right here with us. I pulled out the wine and the wafer to show that God absolves us of all of our sins. He pulled out an apple to remind me of the original sin. He had beaten me at every move, and I couldn't continue. Meanwhile, the Jewish community gathered to ask the rabbi how he had won. I don't have a clue, said the rabbi. First he said to me that we had 3 days to get out of Italy, so I gave him the finger. Then he tells me that the whole country would be cleared of Jews, and I told him we are staying right here. And then what? Asked a woman. Who knows? Said the rabbi. He took out his lunch, so I took out mine. How about a couple for what I've called the happiness theory of humor? The kind of humor where we celebrate ourselves, our special characteristics. During a service at an old synagogue in Eastern Europe, when the Shema was said, half the congregants stood up and half the congregants remained seated. The half that remained seated started yelling at the half that stood up, and the half that stood up began to yell at the half that refused to stand up, causing all kinds of commotion. So the rabbi, learned as he was in the law and the commentaries, didn't know what to do. His congregation suggested that he go and consult a homebound 98-year-old man who was one of the original founders of the shul. Okay, so the rabbi hoped that this elderly man could help him resolve the conflict, and he took a representative of each party with him to go visit the man. When they entered the old man's room, the rabbi asked, "Tell me, is it the congregation's tradition to stand during the prayer, during the Shema?" The old man answered, "No, that is not the tradition." "Tell me," said the other one, "is it the tradition of the congregation to sit during the Shema?" "No, that is not the tradition." Frustrated, the rabbi blurted out, "But the congregants fight all the time, yelling at one another about whether they should stand or they should sit." To which the old man replied, participatory Jewish humor. That is a joke that celebrates human arguing, Jewish skepticism with one another, the ongoing, sometimes contentious conversation. A group of elderly retired men gather each morning in a cafe in Tel Aviv. They drink their coffee and they sit for hours discussing the world situation. Given the state of the world, their talks are usually very depressing. One day, one of the men startles the others by announcing, "You know what?" he says, "I'm an optimist." The others are shocked. But then one of them notices something fishy. Hey, wait a minute, he says. If you're an optimist, why do you look so worried? To which the man replies, you think it's easy being an optimist? Abe and Esther. Okay, I got two more here, and then we'll stop. Abe and Esther are flying to Australia for a two-week vacation to celebrate their 40th anniversary. Suddenly, over the public address system, the captain announces, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid I have some very bad news. Our engines have ceased functioning, and we'll have to attempt an emergency landing. Luckily, I see an uncharted island below us, and we should be able to land on the beach. However, the odds are that we may never be rescued, and that we'll have to live out the rest of our lives on this island. Thanks to the skill of the flight crew, the plane lands safely on the beach. An hour later, Abe turns to his wife and he asks, Esther, did we pay our pledge to the home for the aged yet? No, sweetheart, she responds. Abe, still shaken from the crash landing, asks, did we pay our United Jewish Appeal pledge? No, I'm sorry. I forgot to send the check, she says. One last thing, Esther. Did you remember to send a check for the synagogue building fund this month? He asks. Oh, forgive me, Abe, begged Esther. I didn't send that one either. Abe grabs her at that moment and gives her the biggest hug and kiss in the 40 years of their marriage. Esther pulls away and she asks him, so why did you kiss me like that? And Abe answers, he says to her, they'll find us. One final one. So two old Jewish men are strolling down the street one day when they happen to walk by a Catholic church. They see a big sign posted that says, convert to Catholicism and get $10. You know this one. One of the men stops walking and he stares at the sign. His friend then turns to him and says, Murray, what's going on? Abe, replies Murray, I'm thinking of doing it. Abe says, what, are you crazy? Murray thinks for another minute and he says, Abe, I'm going to go and do it. With that, Murray strides purposefully into the church. 25 minutes later, he comes out with his head bowed. So, asks Abe, did you get your $10? Murray looks up at him and says, is that all you people think about? Now, who can tell that joke? Who can tell that joke? But it does, I mean, while taking a kind of dig at this stereotype about Jews and money, it also, in a way, doesn't it, celebrate the pragmatism, the this worldliness, our capacity to adapt to circumstances and to survive whatever the impediments. This joke is also a celebration of Jewish culture and Jewish values and striving. Let me just conclude by pointing to a comment by the great 20th century poet E.E. Cummings. I don't know whether any of you have read his autobiography. Those of you who know his poetry knows that he never used capital letters. The name of this autobiography comes from a series of lectures at Harvard in 1950, the Norton Lectures. And the title of the book is I, small letter I, colon, six non-lectures. In the first lecture, he talks about his mother, who had experienced a very traumatic automobile crash in which she lost her husband. When she was lying in the hospital near death, all she wanted to do, he says, was to join her loved one. He says about his mother, never have I encountered anyone more joyous, anyone healthier in body and mind, anyone quite so incapable of remembering a wrong or anyone so completely and humanely and unaffectedly generous as my mother. Two indispensable factors in life my mother always maintained were health and a sense of humor. And although her health eventually failed her, she kept her sense of humor to the beginning. That's something about the power, the grandeur, the glory of humor, and especially for us, for Jewish humor. Let's stop for your comments and questions in the minutes that we still have remaining. Those of you who need or want to get up and leave in the middle of our discussion can feel free to do so. Comments, questions, concerns, God forbid, disagreements. Okay, we have a question here.
Yeah.
We have a question here. Yes.
I have a comment.
A comment. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. That's very good. That's very good. Thank you so much. Question.
Everyone has heard a lot of Jewish jokes. How many of you have heard Gentile jokes? Here are three Gentile jokes. Two Gentiles are walking down the street. Down the clothing store. Out comes a salesman. He says, "Come on, I have a wonderful suit for you." He tells Michael goes, "The guy fits him out with a suit. It's kind of funny, but he says, how much?" The guy says, $500. The Gentile says, "I'll take it."
It's a Gentile joke told by Jews. Start it again.
He calls his mother and he says, "I can't come to you tonight. I have a date with a wonderful girl." His mother says,
"Michael, I can't hear from downstairs."
No, he comes to it. He's got a dinner date with his mother at 5:30, and he calls her up at 5 o'clock, and he says, "I can't come." And she says, "Okay." Thanks so much for coming.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I just want to make sure you haven't heard the story about the cow from Minsk.
The cow from Minsk. Yes, I think I have. Tell it to me.
Real quickly. There was a town in Ukraine, which is where my parents are from, and they decided they needed a cow. So they shopped around in Moscow, 500 rubles, but in Minsk, 300 rubles. They brought home the 300 rubles because they couldn't afford the 500. Bring home. Cow's terrific. Plenty of milk, never sick. They decide to breed the cow steps forward. So they bring in a bull, approaches the cow from the rear, and the cow steps forward. Approaches the cow from the left,